Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
Psalm 58, again, is a psalm of David, a psalm where he's confined with his enemies. The title says that to the choir director, set to that Hebrew word that means do not destroy. Now, I think that's referring to a song title. I don't see how it fits into the category of the psalm at all. For David's prayer is socket to him. And so I think it must be to a song title or something like that. Like we have tunes today. We set our, look to the hymnal. Every song has a tune it's put to. And I think probably that's what it's talking about. Now, why don't you read your translation verses 1 through 5 for me? Real loud, verse 1 for me in that Revised Standard Version. Okay, somebody had a Living Bible, read that for me. Okay? Okay, the first phrase again. You hide justice. Justice, you high and mighty politician, the only meaning of the word. Okay, somebody have another, King James, please, verse 1. Okay, Phil? Okay, who has another translation? New English Bible, Jerusalem Bible, something like that? Have you noticed that? Did you notice how Phil's had the word congregation instead of the word gods? In the margin of my Bible is an alternate reading that I think is preferred to all that I've heard so far. The New American Standard doesn't have it in the text either, but I think the alternate reading here. There's a little Hebrew word here, and it's just two consonants in Hebrew, and those are the consonants L and M. And as you know, the consonants are what is inspired. And you can put many different vowels to consonants and get many different words. That's why later on we see the word young lions in verse 6. Those same vowels can also stand for unbelievers. The consonants for the words young lion can also be put different vowels in them. You have the word unbelievers. So many people think that. The word here that has usually been translated by many of the older editions is the word silence. And so what we get is, do you indeed speak righteousness in silence, O God? Now, the concept here is that many think that these are the counselors of Saul. And they know what's right, they know what's true, but they're being quiet. It's not that they are making a false judgment, but they know what's true, and they're not speaking the truth, you see. They're being closed the mouth rather than get in trouble or get in hot water. Now, that to me fits much better here. I think King James has taken a bad reading, Phil. I think it's probably, O gods, the plural of gods, meaning you heavenly hosts and you human men, you've forgotten what justice is. You don't know what it is. Now, you see where it talks about, it's kind of a play on words between O gods and sons of men, but it's speaking to judges or counselors or men who have to make decisions. Now, in the Hebrew times, these judges or counselors were men who sat at the gate, which meant that the town assemblies were, they didn't have a special town assembly hall, but all the renowned men of the city, the elders they would call them, would sit right inside the gates of cities. And any problem was brought to them. Now, that's where where Boaz had to go to get Ruth, you know. And that is where the man who in Proverbs speaks about the righteous woman, that's where he is while his wife is at home working. So these men of the gate would be the counselors or rulers. As you remember, the way that Absalom gained control over his father's kingdom was by sitting at the gate of the city of Jerusalem and speaking lies and innuendos about his father. And as those traitors came in and out, he would speak to them about David in a very slurring way. So that's who it's talking about, these counselors. Now notice in verse 2, something I think is very important. It says, the first phrase has, in your heart, works unrighteousness. The second phrase has you weigh out or met out or this kind of thing, violence with your hands. The Hebrew understanding of the eyes is that the eye is the window of the soul. And what you let your eyes dwell on is what you become. Now the New Testament would put it this way, gird up the loins of your mind. For see, the biblical understanding of sin is that sin begins in the thought life before sin is acted out with the body. So if we can keep the loins of our mind girded up, or if we can keep the windows of our eye pure, there's going to be less chance that our hands get in trouble. This is a real true concept, and I want to say to you, I'm not down a whole bunch on television because I like it a whole lot. I enjoy it very much, the late shows at night and stuff. But there's a lot of trash on television, you know that? And if you let your kids and if you just watch that stuff all the time, we become used to evil. What we do is we put a callousness around our inner thoughts, and we don't begin to think that things really are as bad as the Word of God would say they are. Guard what goes into your mind, because in a real sense, the Bible says, what goes in here will work out here. Now, notice if you will, please, verse 3. The other night I was teaching a course in training on children and conversion, and I really disagree with a man who was claiming that the only place in the Old Testament where it spoke about people being sinful from birth is in Psalm 51, verse 5, where David said, from my mother's womb I was, you know, born in iniquity, that kind of thing. But I want you to look, if you would, at verse 3. For here is a direct parallel to the fact of original sin. I would put it in Presbyterian terms, total depravity. The wicked are estranged from the womb. These who speak lies go astray from birth. And if you'll flip back over with me to Genesis chapter 8, verse 21. Genesis 8, 21. Toward the end of that passage, it says, for the intent of man's heart is evil from his youth. Now, what the word youth means there is be debatable, but there is another example that man is corrupted very, very early. And I would like to turn to Romans chapter 3 and read you verses 10 through 18, if I could, about the biblical, the biblical understanding of man. Now, the Bible, you see, the Bible was written, especially the Old Testament, by a culture of people who were not so much concerned about how a thing, what it was made of, or how to describe it. They were more concerned with the question of, does it function? Does it do what it was intended to do? And so they don't answer all the questions about how sin gets into every person and exactly how it is transmitted and exactly what it is. But it talks about the functioning part of sin, how it corrupts everybody. So listen, this is a series of Old Testament quotes. There is none righteous, not even one. There is none who understands. There is none who seeks for God. All have turned aside. Together they have become useless. There is none who does good. There is not even one. Their throat is an open grave. With their tongues they keep deceiving. The poison of asp is under their lips, whose mouth is full of cursing and bitterness. Their feet are swift to shed blood. Destruction and misery are in their path, and the path of peace they have not known, and there is no fear of God before their eyes. Well, that's a description of mankind from various parts of the Old Testament. I've told you very several times that I'm a 2.5-point Calvinist, and I thought to myself, they don't know what I'm talking about when I say that. They have. Calvin based all his theology on five major points that, if you would put a little watchword for each one, would spell the word tulip. Every one of those little words in tulip stands for a doctrine in Calvinism. I have been heavily influenced by Calvinism. The first point of tulip is total depravity, which means that man is sinful from birth. Man in Adam fell. We live in a fallen world. We are fallen people, every one of us. Not one of us is unfallen. Not one of us has sought after good. Not one of us has followed after God. But all we like sheep have gone astray. Every one of us. So, I think this is a clear understanding. As much as the Old Testament can say about this, it says, man is sinful. And all the questions about, well, it's not fair that everybody's sinning at him and on, well, a Jew wouldn't ask those kind of questions. He would just know that that's the way it happened. Now, if you think it's unfair, let me say to you that whether we get it from birth or whether we just develop it, every one of us has sinned because we've chose to sin. So whether you were born with it or whether you chose later, the outcome is still the same. We're all sinful. That's why the Bible can say that all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. Romans 3:23. Now, notice if you would please the next little phrase that talks about they're like serpents that bite and venom, like a deaf cobra that stops up its ears. Now, as you know, snakes aren't deaf. Snakes don't have ears. They never could hear. They sense vibrations. For the longest time, the ancient world thought the music of the pipe is what charmed the snake. But we've come to find out it's the movement of the pipe that charms the snake. Now, what this is saying here, if I could kind of paraphrase it, is these people have become so bitter that their tongues and their actions are like a poisonous snake. They become so bad they will not hear even if somebody tries to tempt them away from their course of destruction and evil. Even these, it talks about a skillful caster of spells and does not hear the voice of the charmers. Now, it's speaking of two things here. It either means they do not hear when people cry for mercy, that they're crushing or smothering and that kind of thing. They don't hear the cries for mercy. Or it could mean they do not hear God. They have rejected any kind of authority over them, and they do what their hearts and minds want them to do and disregard every other person. I guess if there's one major sin that I think man is guilty of, it's using people as objects to reach our own desires and goals. That's one of the most atrocious crimes in all the world, to use people as things and not somebody made in the image of God. Now, verse 6 through 9, I want to read it because it is very gross. And it has got really some metaphors. Now, when I read this, I want you to put down what kind of metaphors it is. Is it kitchen metaphor? Is it a campfire metaphor? Is it a flower metaphor? You just think and try to put a tag on me as I go down. Oh God, shatter their teeth in their mouth and break out the fangs of the young lions, O Lord, and let them flow away like water that runs off. When he aims his arrows, let them be headless shafts. Let them be as a snail which melts away as it goes along, like the miscarriage of a woman which never sees the sun. Before your pots can feel the fire of thorns, he will sweep them away with the whirlwind, the green and the burning alike. Now, as you followed me, some of you, in the last part of verse 7, totally got away from what I was reading. Yours was totally different. Now, the Living Bible and King James and the New American Standard Version are something like I read. He aims his arrows, but let them be as headless shafts, or they bent his bow and it was weak, something like that. But now the Jerusalem Bible and the Good News Bible and the New English Bible and the Revised Standard Version would have something like this: may they wither like trodden grass. Now, those are radically different kind of ways to translate. What's the problem? The problem here is the Hebrew is very difficult to understand. It's very difficult down in the last, in verse 9. Yours is probably maybe different from the way I read it too. The last part of 7 and verse 9, you might as well just toss it up at which one you're going to believe, because nobody really knows how to translate those things. Many of the newer translations make what they call emendations, which means they change some Hebrew letters. They say what they think it means. Simply to say, we don't really know what the last part of 7 and verse 9 really are speaking of. The whole thing is, it's a symbol of metaphors about destruction. The first one is young lions. Now, when the Bible says young lions, it's not talking about lion cubs. It's talking about the young, strong, mature lions that are stronger and more agile than the older, mature lions. So it's the most vicious, the most ruthless lions. The idea of breaking their teeth is something that's found all through the Old Testament as a way of talking about breaking their power. And then the idea about let the water flow off and run off, and then the idea about either the grass withering or the archer not be able to hit his target for some reason, not be able to hurt him if he does. The snail that melts away. Now, we know that snails don't melt, really. But have you ever seen a track on a wet concrete of a snail, a slug that's crawled that night? And he leaves that little oily slime. It looks like he's leaving part of his body where he crawls. And if you put a little salt on him, he will. But that's the metaphor. Ancient Jews think that the snail reduced himself as he crawled. He left behind part of his body. So remember, this is the language of description and not the language of science. Notice, if you would, please, where it's talked about in verse 9. Before your pots can feel the fire of the thorns. Now, the picture here is this. You're out in the desert. You want to cook your dinner. All you have is some old thorn bushes, no trees, no logs, no grass. So you get these thorn bushes and you break them up and you build a little fire and you put your pot over the fire. But before the fire has a chance to heat the food, a wind comes along and it blows the thorn bushes that are on fire away, and it blows those part of the thorns that hadn't caught on fire yet, and it blows the pot away, and it blows the food away, and everything's gone. Now that's what it's talking about in verse 9. And it suffered quite a bit, if you please, in the Hebrew text. Now, notice verse 10. The righteous will rejoice when he sees vengeance. Now, look at this next little phrase. He will wash his feet in the blood of the wicked. Well, that sounds like a real party, doesn't it? we just stomp around on the dead bodies of those that God socked it to. Isn't that tremendous? Now, people would say, well, that's sub-Christian. No, it's not sub-Christian. It's pre-Christian. It's the Old Testament, remember? This same idea, I think, is media. You say, well, God doesn't think like that. That's got to be human. I read a commentator, and some of these guys just irked me to death. They said, obviously, what we have here is more human inspiration, divine inspiration. What that guy was saying is, the Bible's not inspired here, divine, just men putting his own thing in. But I want you to turn over to Isaiah 61. And I want to read to you what God says. Isaiah 63. I'm going to read 1 through 6. And you listen. Who is this who comes from Edom, whose garments of flowing colors from Bozrah? This one is majestic in his apparel, marching in the greatness of his strength. It is I who speak in righteousness, mighty to save. Why is your apparel red and your garments like the one who treads the winepress? I have trodden the winepress alone, and from peoples there was no man with me. Also I trod them in anger, and I trampled them in my wrath, and their blood is sprinkled on my garments, and I stained all my raiment. For the day of vengeance was in my heart, and my year of redemption has come. And I looked, and there was no one to help, and I was astonished, and there was no one to uphold. And so my own arm brought salvation to me, and my wrath upheld me, and I trod down the peoples in anger, and I made them drink in my wrath, and I poured out their lifeblood on the earth. Now, is that just human? God says, I'm a little upset with you. And the picture he uses there of trotting the winepress. Now, the winepress is often used as a metaphor of the wrath of God. That's where you get the grapes of wrath from. The same picture here about walking in the blood of the wicked is the same idea used of walking in grapes to make wine. So I think we have a very harsh statement here, but it's a little more understandable in the light of that kind of statement in Isaiah. Now, what I think this thing is saying is this. It all comes down to be summarized in verse 11. Now, whoever is saying it says, and men will say, whether it's the righteous or the whole world, we don't know. Surely there is a reward for the righteous. Surely there is a God who judges the earth. Have you ever thought that if God is not going to have a judgment day, our culture and our world is totally unexplainable? Now think of me for a minute. If there is not going to be a judgment day, the world makes no moral sense. For you and I know that oftentimes those who are the most wicked and the most ruthless and the most cruel seem to prosper. If there's not a judgment day, this whole thing's out of kilter. Why is it that sometimes the righteous and those who love the Lord the most and those who seem to really have a sweet spirit, why is it they sometimes get smashed and crushed and knocked down in our world? If there is not a judgment day and a reward day, we cannot explain our world. For you see, we believe that we're going to live here for Christ without the possessions of the world clinging to us. We're going to live here, even if it means the loss of our life, we're going to live for Him. And if there's not something beyond this, then like Paul said in 1 Corinthians, we're of all men most to be pitied. You see, there's got to be a judgment day. There's got to be something to level, to equalize the hate and the terror and the ugliness in this world. What this psalmist is saying is, there's got to be judgment day. Look how the wicked are prospering. Look how these judges who do false judgment, they're doing good. There's got to be a judgment day. And when judgment day comes, then they will say, there is a God who gives rewards to the righteous and who judges on earth. Judgment is as much the part of the gospel as is salvation. That's hard. Matter of fact, judgment is the flip side of God's love. Think about that. Any questions? Comments? Yes. Excuse me? Okay. I'll try to. Total depravity. Okay. Irresistible grace. Limited atonement. You. What does a U stand for? Well, the P is the perseverance of the saints. That's the other one I like. I'll have to look the U up. I've forgotten. I think it's unconditional. It's something like that. I'm not sure it's the word unconditional election, though. It may be. It's called the 5 points of Calvinism. I don't believe in limited atonement, which means that Jesus died just for the elect. And I don't believe in irresistible grace, which means that God chooses some to be saved and they must be saved. There's no choice on their part. They're going to be saved no matter what. Those kinds of things are involved in Calvinism. But out of that, I like very much that man is sinful, totally sinful. And that doesn't mean every man's corrupt. That means that every aspect of man's life has been touched by sin. Man's minds, man's emotions, man's bodies, every relationship's been affected by sin, you see. And of course, the perseverance of the saint, I've talked to you over and over again, that's nothing less than the flip side of once saved, always saved. How do you know if somebody's saved? You don't. You can't tell if someone is really converted. The trick is that those who are really converted will hold out to the end because God's Spirit will keep them. Not themselves, but God's Spirit. So it is a confidence that God will. Now, that doesn't mean we're not going to backslide and get away and run off, but it means that God will always be drawing us back. And in the end, the saved will either be miserable running from God or they will be brought back. So I'll look up that you. I have forgotten. It may be unconditional election, something like that.